how many monthly active users we need to power our data models. So those two things are absolutely critical, bar none. I know you wanted to talk about fast channels, but
yeah,
one of the things that's driving fast channels are fast channels as opposed to I'm going to load up a bunch of video on demand assets. A fast channel will drive more engagement, more ad views, more session and time spent than anything else. And we identified that in 2015 when we launched our first channel at Calkins. And I spent 3 years evangelizing that, you know, a free ad-supported streaming channel dwarfed anything that you could do with video on demand. But the challenge is it's hard. Even in 2023, it's hard.
Welcome to the News Nirvana Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Parker. The News Nirvana Podcast features conversations with media professionals from across the country, highlighting our ever-evolving business models and showcasing the strong and effective journalism produced each and every day. This podcast is made possible to you by the generosity of Blox Digital. Blox Digital empowers content producers to connect with their worldwide audiences at scale and continuously transform to achieve their business goals. Contact Blox Digital today to learn more about how they can help you thrive, and you can connect with them at BloxDigital.com. Hello, and welcome back to the News Nirvana Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Parker. With me today, I'm excited about this one, Guy Tasaka from Tasaka Digital. We're gonna get nerdy, Guy. We're going to talk about technology. We're going to do one of my favorite subjects, which is keeping up with technology and not fighting it like we used to in our industry. I also should mention that you are now a technology columnist for Editor and Publisher magazine, which I love what they're doing with that magazine. I really feel like it's kind of hitting a new stride that we haven't seen for a while.
You're doing a great job.
We talked when we first met a few weeks ago on a video call, and you said something. You said technology is our tool for embracing the future. So I just kind of, to me, that sets up everything, because I feel like if you go back to the 80s and 90s, our industry fought technology hard. And I think a lot of the things that we're struggling with now could have been easier if we'd made some different decisions. If we'd agreed in the late 90s, it was okay to charge for content, it would have fixed a lot of things, or at least prevented some of the things that we're doing now. And I know that's oversimplifying, but I feel like we are an industry that didn't really embrace technology very well as it really started to boom. And now we're being forced to embrace that technology. And so I'm curious, as a guy who has, you've spent your entire professional life inside this bubble, like, are you seeing the industry embrace it? Is that really a thing?
No, thank you, Nick. Thanks for the opportunity to talk to your audience. But that's a great segue. I just wrote a column for Editor and Publisher, and it talks about the different phases of technology and business strategy. And I broke the history of local media into 1.0, 2.0, and 3.0. And we're currently in 3.0. And we have to embrace a lot of different technologies that are very different than what came before. And to your point,
that's not like being stuck in Windows 3.0, is it?
It's not 3.0. It's actually a good thing.
Okay.
You know, as we enter this era of 3.0, which is, I use 2020 as kind of the starting point for 3.0, where strategies change, tech stacks change, but also we look back at 1.0 and 2.0, and what worked in 1.0, what didn't work in 2.0, and we reassemble everything for 3.0. And it's you talked about the paywall. You know, you talked about we should have charged back in 95. I don't know if people remember that the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal were the first major websites. Mm-hmm. The Wall Street Journal from day one charged. The New York Times made it free ad supported, and the industry looked up and followed what the New York Times was doing rather than embrace what the journal was doing. So, you know, those two models were front and center, and the industry could have made a choice, and, you know, they made the choice to go free ad supported. So it's really interesting, you know, how things have come full circle over 20 years.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as we're shifting now to more paywalls, and even I don't even know if you can always call them paywalls now. Like, we're new ways, because we've had to change how we view our audience, how we view our readers, our viewers, right? And they are a part of the revenue stream now, more so than they ever have been.
They are. And the challenge of the industry is kind of, I don't want to call it innovator's dilemma, but now the industry's gotten so used to digital ad supported revenue from the website. They're so used to digital subscription revenue from the website. But those two things have both kind of hit their ceiling. It's never combined. They're never going to get us to where we need to be. So the next
thing. Well, and they're not even getting us to where we were, right?
Exactly. Or where we need to be, right? Considering the industry, the revenue for the industry is, you know, 10% of what it was 20 years ago, or roughly 10% of what it was in 2005. So I think as we introduce 3.0 and what the strategy is going forward there, we're going to have to give up some of what we gained in the previous era, which was digital subscriptions. So a lot of companies, you know, they're going out, they're getting digital subscriptions. You hit a ceiling and retention becomes your biggest problem. You're losing more than you're gaining, and then it becomes very expensive to try to maintain and grow. So in the latest editor and publisher article, we talk about registration, first party data, and making every single user be addressable via advertising and transactional revenue. So really, the mindset going forward is we need to think like B2B publishers, not consumer publishers. We need to know who all our users are. We need to be able to segment our users and make them available to local businesses call them advertisers. They're really marketing partners. You know, what made us so great in 1.0, the period up to 2005, was we used our content to... There was a great value exchange. We created great content, and for that great content, we amassed this great audience, and we were able to create this marketplace. You know, in the second phase, we lost that marketplace advantage because of social, because of search, because of a lot of things. But you know, this next phase is going to be both amazing and scary. But it depends how well you embrace the strategies and the technology, but it's not what we have today.
I want to go backward a little bit, because something you said struck me there, where you said we need to be B2B and not B2C. Why is that difference? Because, you know, all our careers, you know, and mine's only 25-30 years, but you know, all of our careers has been audience. We go to that consumer, to that who's buying our product, that, you know, our news product, but you're kind of pointing to a shift there.
Yeah. So I don't mean that we need to be a B2B publisher. We need to think like a B2B publisher. You think like a B2B publisher. B2B publisher knows every single person in their market. If I'm a medical journal, if I'm a, you know, a business journal, I know everybody who's in my data set, my audience set. And in a lot of ways, I know everything about them. I know who they are. I enrich the data. I think right now, the challenge that local media faces is first-party data means collecting an email address, you know, or a phone number. In the B2B space, you get that email address and you enrich it. You know everything about their company. You know everything about that person. And we need to enter into that sort of into that model.
How do we do that? How do we get that kind of shift and start collecting those things and building that database? I mean, as we all know, data is everything.
And you know, you look at the the most valuable companies in the world: Amazon, Google, Facebook. They're data companies. They use our shopping information, our discussion information, our browsing information, and put us into audience segments. And then they use that audience information to make us addressable by all their advertisers. So, you know, the tools that we need, I know Blocks Digital has some great first-party data tools and audience segmentation tools. But I think, you know, we need to understand customer data platforms, which is the, you know, the heart and soul of what a B2B publisher uses. And we just need to be a lot smarter about what we do with the data. We have so much information as local media publishers, the way people come in to our websites, use our social, use our emails. You know, if we're able to track it and say, okay, this person was looking at home ads, they're looking at neighborhood information, they're looking at school information, they're a young family, you know, or so now we can create these data segments to make them addressable to advertisers.
Right, right. Well, I want to shift a little bit our conversation. I want to go to technology tools for producing the news. Mm-hmm. You know, I think a lot of people, the three things you think of immediately, right, are mobile publishing, now video, right? We got to use more video, and the scare, both the exciting and scary one, the topic of the day is AI, and I think are those the three things that really need to be talked about right now? Are we still focusing on mobile publishing?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think a lot of people, just because mobile is very expensive to do, if you were trying to do it yourself, you have vendors to work with. What people don't realize is the engagement of a mobile user. A mobile user, it's not even close to what a web user is. I'll give you an example. I ran mobile at Gatehouse, which is now Gannett, and we had 312 properties at the time, and we were able to really dive deep into the data associated with each. So we found that a native mobile user generates roughly 10 times more page views and ad views than a typical web user. So really? With I guessed, but I didn't believe until I saw the data. And it's 10x more than a mobile web user, and it's 20x more than a website user, because they are highly engaged. They come back, you know, 10 times more per month than a web user, and they stay a lot more. And I mean, think about your personal habits. You're on your phone a lot more than you're on a website or a tablet. Right. We just need to really be able to monetize that, embrace it. When I first worked on paid content, one of the things that, in fact, I found the deck for it. I worked on Memphis Commercial Appeal's pay model back in 2011. And I found the initial kickoff deck, and it was called Mobile Publishing Strategy. And that's where we thought the bulk of the benefit would come from.
When you say mobile publishing, mm-hmm. what are you really talking about that news organizations need to be focused on? Because that means more than,
sure,
I have a mobile app. It means more than somebody saved the shortcut to the website on their home screen,
sure,
right?
Sure.
When you are talking about mobile publishing and being intentional, reaching your audience in that way, where they are, what are you really talking about? What tools and things are you talking about?
Sure. A mobile app. So what's really interesting is, and great that you brought that up. A lot of publishers say, we don't need a native mobile app. We have our native website. We have our mobile web. That was the big right. argument back then. And if you look at what happened, and I'm sorry, I keep referring to the period of 2.0. 2.0 was spent on driving page views at any cost. And as a result, so I would argue sometimes even unprofitably, as a result, the industry depended heavily on search and social traffic. And mobile web captures all the search and mobile traffic. So you have I won't call it disloyal, but people who don't even know your brand. They just saw you on search, or they saw you on a social post. They came to your site, they read the story, and they're gone. And whether they come back again, they don't care because they followed that story. That doesn't promote a lot of engagement or loyalty. Whereas somebody who took the time to download a mobile app, sometimes it's tied to your paid content strategy. You log in to your account and you're able to come back. And it's a convenience thing, right? If you think about a mobile app is a curation tool. You're bringing in stories from around your owned and operated original stories. You know, use it to create, that was one of the strategies that we had at Gatehouse, was we wanted to accelerate the velocity of the stream. So in other words, we wanted to post frequently. We wanted to put ads in there that were expiring coupon ads or things that had we wanted to create FOMO, your fear of missing out.
Right.
Both through content and advertising. But that's really, you know, the mindset that you need to have in a mobile app. It's not lift and shift and take what you had on your website. It's think about what the mobile user experience is. Think about why somebody has a phone. They want to be informed. They want to be updated. They want to find out where, you know, that Voodoo Donuts is having, buy one bucket, get another bucket for
free. Now I want donuts. Thanks a lot.
But that's really, you know, you want to create the fear of missing out in an accelerated stream.
Right. You're talking about building that relationship with your audience, and they have made a choice by downloading the app, by signing up. They've made a choice to be involved.
Exactly. Exactly.
What, let's go beyond that a little bit. And then institute video. Like, everybody's talking about, we have to use more video. You have to have video on your social feeds. You have to have video on your app and your website. I mean, that's how we're drawing people in, right?
I think everybody's really attracted by video CPMs against any other CPM. Video CPMs are, you know, 5-10 times higher than display CPMs. So why wouldn't you? But, you know, video, you need a strategy for video. That's really a TBD, and people are trying to figure that out right now. I know you wanted to talk about. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was going to say, you know, when we had a few episodes ago, we were talking to Kyle Rickoff about data. And, you know, one of the things he said is we're still figuring out how to track video well. Like, those stats aren't awesome yet. We're still trying to find how to track and what to track with video.
Video analytics are horrible, especially if you get them natively out of the. There are a couple of, I'll call it video analytics companies that I'm working with. And as I sat through the initial demos, I was absolutely blown away that they had these metrics. When we first started doing fast channels, that was one thing that we had to understand were the analytics. But I had a whole analytics team that was tagging everything. That was, you know, we spent a lot of time and effort in understanding our analytics, but I don't know that a lot of folks that are doing video are really, really leaning into the data. They're getting things that are out of the box or from the vendors, but, you know, a lot of that is not, call it suboptimum.
Right. Yeah. Well, and I think too, what we all are learning too is even knowing what to look for. Like, what pieces of that data are important to your goals is a hard place to even start with.
That's a fair point. Engagement's critical. How long people are. Well, when we build our video models, we look at two things really: session length and number of sessions per month, because from that we can determine the total streaming hours. But we can also identify how many monthly active users we need to power our data models. So those two things are absolutely critical, bar none. I know you wanted to talk about fast channels, but
yeah,
what one of the things that's driving fast channels are fast channels, as opposed to I'm going to load up a bunch of video on demand assets. A fast channel will drive more engagement, more ad views, more session and time spent than anything else. And we identified that in 2015 when we launched our first channel at Calkins. And I spent 3 years evangelizing that, you know, a free ad supported streaming channel dwarfed anything that you could do with video on demand. But the challenge is it's hard. Even in 2023, it's hard.
What did you see there? What did you see in engagement and traffic? Like, what stood out to you that this was? I mean, that's a whole separate effort and team, right? You can't just like you said earlier about, you know, website to mobile app. You can't just shift the content and repurpose it. This is intentionally different thing. So what were you looking at?
We were looking at time spent. So we looked at I mentioned session length and returns. In a video on demand asset, we were seeing, you know, 2 minute engagement, 3 minute engagements. To watch a fast channel, and just so everybody understands, FAST stands for free ad supported streaming television. And if you think about it, it's a 24/7 linear stream. It looks just like what you know today as television, but you're watching it off of a streaming device, a Roku, Fire, Apple, even off your phone. So we created 24/7 channels from our TV stations and our newspapers. And we saw that the engagement metric, time spent for our fast channel, was an hour and 30 minutes. Every time somebody came, they stayed for an hour and 30 minutes.
Wow.
Versus 3 minutes for a VOD asset. What we found that, and this is for the broadcasters out there, broadcasters would stream their live news, and then they would put a slate up, you know, which said, we'll be back, and they would show the time spent. So at the stations that we own, that we did a live stream and a slate, we found that the average engagement time was 31 minutes, which is roughly the length of time people spent.
Right.
But if we could create a 24/7 stream, they would come and they would watch it. And if I can take a step back, why we figured out that worked. So Calkins Media leaned into video in the early, in 2013. We launched a newsroom. We were really committed to video. A few months in, we realized that our engagement numbers were not growing. Our audience wasn't growing and our time spent wasn't growing. So we went and we interviewed some folks that were really doing video well. Who were studying digital video at the time, including several PhDs and industry experts. And we asked, who's making money in digital video? And their response was, nobody. And we said, surely there must be somebody making money in video. And they listed off several of the biggest YouTube creators. This is 2013. So it was the Young Turks and you know, some of the other ones that were really... So we said that can't be. And the more we looked into it, we realized nobody was making money in video. Then we looked over at Calkins owned TV stations and newspapers. So we launched into video at our newspapers. So we looked over at our TV colleagues and we said, how are you guys making money? And we broke down their data into a giant financial model. And we realized it was all about engagement and time spent. And the only way that we could replicate it was by creating a 24/7 linear channel.
Wow.
Just by stacking video assets. And that was kind of the beginning of the concept of FAST.
The News Nirvana podcast is made possible by the generosity of Blox Digital. Blox Digital empowers content producers to connect with their worldwide audiences at scale and continuously transform to achieve their business goals. Contact Blox Digital today to learn more about how they can help you thrive. Connect with them at BloxDigital.com. And the numbers quickly backed up that people were staying, and they were consuming.
People were staying. At the time, we had I want to say 600,000 downloads of our TV station app. And I think since we sold it, I heard the number went over 2 million. But wow. you had hundreds of thousands of monthly active users. I mean, our small local station dwarfed the nationals at the time. So that was, you know, just connecting some dots. You know, why is TV successful? Why is VOD not successful? Well, if we could replicate that experience,
wow,
we could see similar success.
Wow. So if you look around now, are there some examples now in 2023 that you can point to that they're doing it? I want to say, you probably can't say do it right, but doing well, that are embracing that.
I think something I haven't watched it yet. But the Washington Post just announced last week that they launched the FAST channel, and they're going to be on Freevee, which, you know, it makes sense. Jeff Bezos owns both, right? So, I know of at least one other major group that's launched the FAST channel, and several smaller groups. But, you know, it takes planning. It takes, it takes a lot of content. And one of the things that I think newspapers and TV stations need to understand is you don't have to create all your original content. You can be the audience aggregator. You can be the destination and go aggregate and curate a lot of content that exists in your community, both from businesses and local creators, and be the destination. You don't need to be the creator. And own all the ad inventory.
Yeah, it is so as you work with people to strategize and make that plans, what kind of content and what kind of things are people we looking for to fill these channels? Because I think it's easy to look at, you know, the Post and some of bigger market TV stations. I mean, you know, the content that they generate on their own is huge. But if you're a smaller organization and you're, you know, what kinds of content, how are you looking to fill that? Because, you know, when you first say 24 hours of content, that's a daunting task.
It is a daunting task. Right now I'm working with a media company who is creating both they're using their channel as an interstate and an intrastate marketing opportunity. So think of it as I'm in a market. I'm in Portland, Oregon. I don't know anything about the coast. I don't know anything about the mountains. I don't know anything about the southern part of it. But each of those destinations want to market to the other destination to have people come to visit, right? So it's let's tell great stories about our city. Let's talk about and market it to the rest of the state and the rest of the country and the world, you know. So telling those stories, there's a lot of creators in each market. There's a lot of vested interest in bringing people to the market. Things like that, you know. That's my opinion. A really great use of a FAST channel. Really great use of the technology. Where I've seen it not do as well is when a local media company or a pure play tries to be the fifth news channel in a market. We don't need a fifth news channel in a market, right? We have the four networks, you know, they're limping along. You're not going to tell a different story, but be different, be original.
Think of the stories that aren't being told.
Exactly. Think about the creators that there's some great content out there by YouTube creators, and it's not the A-list of creators who have, you know, millions of subscribers. It's really, you know, the folks who have a couple hundred, couple thousand. They put just as much effort into their storytelling. You know, they create great pieces, but they just don't have the audience or the venue to display. YouTube's a big place.
Are you talking making partnerships with these creators?
Absolutely. I think media companies need to really embrace the creator community. You know, you're a creator. This is a podcast, right? there's, you know, great video creators. There's great audio creators out there. I think it absolutely is a direction that local media needs to really understand and embrace.
That makes so much sense. But I also feel like that's almost a hard shift for our brains in the industry to like, oh, we need to go partner with those other creators, those not news. I mean, we're a little snobbish, right, in our world. But that's, I mean, it makes sense. It's just, it's a hard thing to get my brain to switch.
You know, one of the things that was great, great about COVID, but what happened with kind of how media transitioned during COVID.
Absolutely.
You know, you had weather and TV anchors doing broadcasts from home. You had, you know, Jimmy Fallon and American Idol, you know, finals broadcasting from home. So I think the authenticity and versus high production quality that broadcast was used to really kind of leveled out during the pandemic.
I think you are absolutely correct. I think we learned that we can create content anywhere, anytime. But also even just like, you know, what I noticed is because the whole world started using video conference calls, right? So we got used to lower quality audio, lower quality video. So now if I have a guest on that doesn't have, you know, a great mic set up or whatever, right? It's fine. I used to futz about it, right? And really be concerned. But I think our eyes and our ears got used to that, and that, you know, good content can come from anywhere.
I always say people don't want drills, they want holes, right? People wanted the content. They didn't care how the content got made. And I think we're a lot more open to differences now. You know, there's not a template or a boilerplate. This needs to look like TV. It doesn't. It needs to, I don't want to say, look more like YouTube. I don't know.
Well, that's the next question. So we talk about you are either creating new content, repurposing content, partnering with people for additional content. When you build this channel, this fast channel, does it look like TV? Does it look like high production value TV? Or is it some does, some doesn't, but it's still good content?
Great question. I think we're in this kind of evolutionary period where we love YouTube. I think YouTube is not even close. If you take everything that's on YouTube, it's not even close to the aggregation of everything else that's watched. Right. So this is now the norm. You know, I think it's an evolution. I think we're going to see creators get better. I wrote a piece in Editor and Publisher about my takeaway from NAB this year. And 10 years ago when I attended NAB, it was 100% catering to the broadcast industry. And what you're seeing now is the equipment and software manufacturers realize that the creator community is much larger than the broadcast community. And they buy equipment more often. Broadcasters buy things every 10 years. YouTube creators, a lot of them, you know, will go out and buy the latest and the greatest. So I think there's going to be this huge transition. And again, to shamelessly plug the article that I recently wrote in Editor and Publisher, is the barriers to entry are totally erased for a newspaper company. The high capital expense, the infrastructure, printing press, that's all gone. You don't need that anymore. You don't need an FCC license, and you don't need a, you know, $2 million studio to be the next version of the TV station in your market. So it's gonna force media companies to move quicker, strategize faster, and not get stuck into their workflow, their legacy equipment, their legacy staffing. In order for media companies to go forward, you have to think like not a media. I mean, you have to think like not a newspaper, not a TV station. You have to be nimble. You have to have a nimble tech stack and a nimble strategy.
Yeah, no, I think you're right about that. And technology, you know, when I first started out doing the podcasting and production of stuff, I, you know, my rule was when I feel like I've earned it, when I've gotten good enough, I'll buy the next toy. I'll step up. But what's funny is, you know, I have, you know, whatever I've spent on all my cameras, all my mics, the best camera I own now is one of these. That's one of the highest quality cameras I've got. And I can take that and a couple lav mics and go out and produce. And you'll never know the difference.
It's your phone is better than a lot of TV equipment that existed 5 years ago.
Exactly.
One of my observations at NAB this year versus 10 years ago, or even 5 years ago, were you would see a lot of these journalists reporting from the field. You would see their light set up. They would be standing in a corner. And I saw technology. I would see these mobile journalists, these international mobile journalists, and they would have these tactical backpacks, these things that look like phones, but they were like, I didn't know what they were, but they were reporting from the field. They were picking up B-roll. They were streaming back, and somebody back home was editing. It was mind blowing how the how news gathering has changed, how reporting. I would see people walking through the show talking to themselves, talking to their phone, reporting on TikTok or Instagram, and it was it's game changing.
Well, and I think that leads to me, and maybe this is one of the last things we kind of hit here in our time is, okay, yes, technology moves fast. We have to embrace it. I think we can agree we're better at it. We're better at embracing it. We're better at finding the tools. But how do you balance the constant chase of what's new with using the tools to best achieve our goals? Because our goal is to produce the news, to collect and produce the news for the people. How do you find that balance? Otherwise, you're always chasing. You're always buying the next thing.
That's a great question. I'm actually right now, I don't say I backed into it, but at the request of a number of the folks I work with, CEOs and publishers, they ask me, will you help us? Will you advise us on technology? Because at this point, we don't even know what we don't know. So, and the base of information and technology is so vast. But to your point about your job is creating news, I would argue that on the business side, the job is creating a revenue model, right? A sustainable revenue model. So I don't think you can look at what the latest and the greatest is. You need to figure out what's going to solve your problem. And you may even be a generation behind the latest and the greatest. I would say chase the latest and the greatest if it gives you efficiencies that say, that's a strategic and tactical advantage, but you don't need the latest and greatest, but you don't need something that's 5 or 10 years old that you're, right, keeping on life support and duct taping together so that you don't have to buy the latest. I think the advantage, you need to pick a point, figure out what problems you need to solve, and also plan for the future. I'm working with several broadcast groups right now, and their biggest challenge is order management systems. They're using legacy order management. So I'm a big proponent of you need to be an omni-channel seller. You can't sell your core product and bolt on Google and Facebook and, have to work through your, submitting your billing. So there's a number of omni-channel order management systems that lets you work in one entire revenue workflow and everything happens on the back end. Those are not the latest and greatest, but that gives you incredible operating efficiencies, right? That's what you need to look for, is operating efficiencies. How do you save money? How do you save time? How do you save mistakes? That's really kind of the North Star, is solving your problem, but building for the future with an eye toward the future on the content and the revenue sides.
Finding the tools,
embrace the tools, and understand why you're doing it. But to your point about you being a creator, you didn't buy the mic and the setup and have the system that we're on because they were cool. It's because it saved you so much time and it brought your costs down.
30% cool.
Okay, it was part. I mean, there's always that.
I like shiny.
You like shiny, but you're also practical, right? There's a lot of things out there right now that you can go down a rabbit hole on. But you know, as long as you're solving a problem and experiencing cost, you know, and time efficiencies, that's where you really need to focus right now.
Right. Well, Guy, I appreciate you taking a little bit of time today and talking to us about technology and all the tools that we can go. I know we kind of bounced a little bit, but also stayed. I love this show, but sometimes I wish we could have 3 hours and really, really get in. But I wouldn't get the audience data that you want with a 3 hour show. But I appreciate you taking some time and talking with us today.
Thank you so much, Nick. I appreciate it, and happy to share with the industry any questions you might have. Feel free to reach out to me.
Well, and that leads me to my next thing. If people want to follow you on the socials or connect with you, how can they do that?
Sure. My website is tasakadigital.com, and I call it innovation coaching for media executives. It's really kind of demystifying technology and putting together a plan, both from a staffing level, because that's one of the questions I get all the time. How do I staff for the future? How do I structure for the future? And then also tech stacks. But you follow me, editor and publisher. I have a monthly column. And feel free to reach me through my website.
Awesome. Awesome. Thank you, Guy. I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Nick.
That'll wrap us up for this episode. We'll talk to everybody next time. The News Nirvana podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or most any of your favorite podcast apps. The News Nirvana podcast is made possible by the generosity of Blox Digital. Connect with them at BloxDigital.com. The News Nirvana podcast is produced by Fredcasts. Think, speak, act.